gender has been seen as a sort of separate silo, or even, dare I say it, a ghetto in economic studies. And so people tend to say, well, yes, we'll look at all of these things and then we will look at gender. I'm Jayati Ghosh. I'm a professor of economics at University of Massachusetts Amherst. And I taught in India for 35 years before this.
Where were you teaching?
At Jawaharlal Nehru University in New Delhi.
Welcome to this Women in Economics podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. Today's episode, our second in this series that showcases extraordinary work by women in a field dominated by men, looks at why care work is rarely captured in GDP and how our vision of productivity is skewed because of it.
We can't understand macroeconomic behavior or even how ordinary markets function without recognizing these gender differences because of unpaid labor.
Rhoda Metcalf sat down with Jayati Ghosh, whose work shows that unrecognized caregivers, disproportionately women, of course, provide the base to our economy.
Your work looking at gender inequality has received a lot of attention, especially in recent years. And you really highlight the connection between the care economy and the income gender gap. Can you explain this connection?
So imagine a situation where there's a bunch of work that has to be done in a society, and it's not always very pleasant work. A lot of it is quite thankless. It involves a lot of drudgery. Sometimes it's very arduous. And so there is really a question of how do you get people to do this, especially if it's not going to be paid. And that really, in a nutshell, is care work. Societies have historically handled this by creating a whole set of what is called the gender construction of society, whereby the responsibility of care is given to women and girls. And women see this as their duty. They see this as part of their life. They're brought up thinking that this is what they will do. And if they do other stuff, like have a job, earn a living, that's kind of extra. So the work that is being done for free is sometimes not even recognized. And of course, it's not valued. So the women who do this, first of all, do not get social respect and esteem. They don't get equal bargaining power, even within their households and in the broader society. They'd have less of a voice.
Because they're not actually earning any money.
That's right. And, you know, your work is defined by how much you earn.
Right.
So the people who do a lot of unpaid work, which is dominantly care work, are automatically devalued by society and even by themselves. There are so many investigators who go to do surveys and, you know, the husband says, oh, my wife doesn't do anything. She's at home.
As if she wasn't doing anything at home. She's sitting there.
Yes, exactly. And even if they recognize that it's important for, you know, individual well-being, it's not seen as an economically productive thing. So that's the first, is that the women get devalued. Because they are devalued by society and by the economy, when they do go out to work, in fact, they earn lower wages. You know, you can get the woman's work for free. So when you are paying them, you're doing them a favor almost.
Right. And you have mentioned also in your work that the very fact that so many jobs that involve care are connected to women, that also those tend to be devalued.
Absolutely. So that's the next implication, is that once women enter the labor market, they earn less and they work in worse conditions. But then they get clustered into certain occupations. Many of those occupations are similar to those that they're doing at home for free. You know, domestic work, nursing, you know, childcare, looking after kindergartens, all of that kind of thing. So then those occupations where there are lots of women on average tend to have lower wages, so that there's a wage penalty even for the men who do that. A male nurse gets a lower wage. A male kindergarten teacher gets a lower wage, and so on. And then there's the fact that all of this is an enormous subsidy to the paid economy, which is something that the paid economy never recognizes. Because remember, it's absolutely essential. It involves looking after those who cannot look after themselves. The young, the old, the sick, and even the healthy who need other stuff done for them. It's really a subsidy to all of the other stuff. You can pay a worker less because you know that he's going to get access to unpaid goods and services back home.
Like childcare.
Like childcare, or like food cooked at home for you, or like, you know, a clean home and etc. You know, all of those things. And it's not just private employers. It's the whole society. You can palm off a lot of care, the care of the elderly, for example, which should be, you know, a social responsibility. But you know that families will do it. Well, guess who will do it in a family? It's the women.
Most of the time.
Most of the time. And there's a lot of constant socializing of young girls from an early age to be told that, you know, these are the things you will be doing. And we're proud of you that you will be doing all these because you are selfless, you are caring, you are a nurturing type.
And that actually brings up something that I think is really interesting in your work. This idea that the fact that women do all this unpaid care work really contradicts some of the basic principles of economics. Can you talk about that?
You know, a lot of mainstream economics, neoclassical economics broadly, is based on what is called methodological individualism. That is to say, the idea that at the base is this unit, the individual, and it is his or her personal utility that is maximized. And that personal utility is largely based on material gain or some combination of gain and leisure. In fact, there's a reason why it's called rational economic man. The reason you can get away with that is because you're completely ignoring care work. You cannot explain care work that way. There isn't anything in it directly for you. You're doing it out of love, out of concern. And that means that there is a massive decline in bargaining power of that care provider because you can't just threaten to withdraw. Let's say a worker can go on strike and say, I will not work unless you pay me this minimum. Whereas when you're looking after an infant, you're not going to say, I'm going to stop looking after this infant. I'm going to stop looking after my elderly mother. And that means that you don't have the bargaining power to demand either recognition or respect or better conditions or even decent remuneration or even that this work gets redistributed among other people.
Because it's an assumption that you will do it. You have been doing it. So why should anyone else take it on?
And you will do it because you care about that other person. So in a cynical way, even if not explicitly, society and the household takes advantage of that.
There's this weird contradiction that on one side, this product, which is care, being taken care of, that you get it for free. Yeah. As, you know, if you're a child, your mother takes care of you. Yeah. And yet it also has an enormous value in terms of the well-being of your society, of your family.
You know, this is one of those things that I thought the pandemic would bring out so clearly for people, but somehow it hasn't brought it out enough, which is that care is absolutely essential. Without adequate provision of care, you don't just have unhappy and unhealthy societies. You have economies that are not resilient, that collapse.
So you focused on some of your recent research has looked at this issue also in India. So how does the devaluing of women's care work play out in the country that you grew up in?
You know, India is one of the most extreme examples of how terrible it is to devalue work and what implications it has, not just for women, but for the whole society and economy. So in India, we have one of the largest gender gaps in wages in the world. So one of the striking things about the Indian labor market that a lot of people have spent beating their heads over is why does India have such a significantly low and declining share of women's work participation? Okay, so it was as low as 36% in the 1990s, and it's down to 18%. The latest data suggests that it's even 14%. Now, that's crazy, right? In an economy that was supposedly growing at 5 to 10% for two decades, and yet we have this massive decline in women's workforce participation. It turns out that a very large part of that is related to an increase in the number of women who are doing unpaid work at home. We have survey data that tell us that if you take the larger definition of work, what the ILO now recognizes as work, including all of the care and extended care activities, which means, you know, the household duties, cooking, cleaning, etc., looking after the young, the old, the sick, fetching water, fetching fuel wood, kitchen gardening, poultry raising, all of these activities. If you include those in work, then it's not 18% of women who are working, it's 86% are working. Slight difference, right?
Right.
And so what we've really seen over this period is a shift away from paid and recognized work to unpaid and unrecognized work for women.
Where does that shift come from?
you know, I talked about how care work, unpaid care work is a subsidy to the formal economy. So here is an accumulation process using this unpaid work as a way of subsidizing its own expansion.
So can you give me an example of that? I'm trying to imagine what you're talking about.
Many. So we have in India this extraordinary system of what I suppose you would call para workers or informal workers working for government programs. We run one of the largest nutritional programs for pregnant mothers, infants. It's called the Integrated Child Development Services. Okay, they're based on what are called Anganwadi workers or nursery workers and helpers. These nursery workers and helpers are not classified as government employees. They are classified as volunteers, which means they don't have to be paid the minimum wage. And in fact, the official national wage for them is something like 1/3 or 1/4 of the official minimum wage. We have a national health mission, which again is providing basic health services across the country to every settlement. It's run on the basis of, wait for it, accredited social health activists. Activists now, not even volunteers, activists. Who are these women? And the acronym for this is ASHA, which is a cruel irony because the word ASHA means hope in Hindi. So the ASHAs get even less than the nursery workers and helpers. They sometimes don't get anything. They're paid on a piece rate because it's assumed that the community will pay for them if they help them to get an injection, if they take them to get a visit, if they assist during maternity, the community will reward them. Can you imagine a health system and a nutrition system running on the basis of such massively underpaid workers?
So I guess the rationale there is that if they weren't doing this work, they'd be at home doing something similar for nothing.
Exactly. So it's a very convenient way for the entire growth process to rely on this unpaid work. And it's never recognized that this has been such a major contributor to the economic expansion of India in the last three decades.
Okay. So, the fact that care work is done primarily by women and it's unpaid, unrecognized, what's the impact of that in terms of public policy, for example? And does everyone in society lose because of this lack of recognition, or is it only women who lose?
Oh, I think everyone loses. But I also just want to highlight another angle to this, which I think is quite important nowadays, which is that globalization of care. We actually have a value chain in care services now. Women in professional occupations in advanced economies who are able to hire out, outsource their care work to, let's say, live-in maids, who are often immigrants. These immigrant maids come from developing countries where they have left families behind, and they are able to send back remittances, which enables that family to then hire in some other live-in maid or part-time maid or whatever. That part-time maid often has a family to look after, and that work will then be done in unpaid fashion by her mother, her sister, her child. So there is a global value chain even in care, and that has been very important in enabling the greater labor market involvement of women in the North. Many countries like Sri Lanka, the Philippines, their balance of payments depends on sending out care workers into some of these advanced countries. How does it damage the society as a whole rather than just women? Of course, it's rough on women. But there is both a micro and a macro way in which it damages others. So imagine you have to go out to work and then you can't afford to hire someone to come in and do all the other care work. So you get home late at night, maybe 8 o'clock or something, and then you have to cook and clean and look after the children. You're not going to do it so well. You're not going to give the same quality of goods and services that you could do if you were just at home.
To your own children.
To your own children. You will not be able to. It's not because you don't want to, but you can't. And this is, again, something which nobody recognizes. Public policy doesn't even factor in time poverty as an aspect of multidimensional poverty. But at the same time, what this is doing is, first of all, reducing your ability to actually engage many more women in more qualified and more creative and more productive activities, because you're confining them to what is ultimately a lot of drudgery. I mean, yes, there's some good bits to it, but if it were more fairly and equally redistributed, you would actually get more women being able to work, more contribute to economic activity.
I mean, you're not necessarily maximizing your human resources of that situation.
Absolutely. And I think that is something that policymakers, again, just simply don't get. Austerity packages. They all assume that someone is going to do that work when governments stop providing hospital nursing care in hospitals or basic facilities or, you know, childcare services. They don't think that it's going to stop happening. They know it's going to be done. And it's going to be done by unpaid work in the household. So governments, in fact, rely on this to cheapen the way that economies work. This is very short-sighted because it implies not just a massive loss of, shall we say, human skills, creativity, the potential, but it also means over time that you are getting all the wrong notions of what is productivity. In India, for example, labor productivity has been going up a lot. But as I just told you, we've had a big decline in women's workforce participation. And so all those women who are dropping out of the workforce, they're not seen as workers anymore. And so that's why your productivity is going up.
Right, because you're not counting in all of the workers that support the income earning.
Exactly.
So, I mean, I'm just kind of curious. I mean, how did you come to focus so much on women's economic status? I mean, this very uneven playing field for men and women. Was this something that you were aware of yourself growing up? Or is it an issue that you've come to later on in your career?
I have to confess it's something that I came to later on. I was very privileged. I grew up in a very emancipated household. It's true that my mother was a homemaker and therefore did all the unpaid work. But we were just two sisters and we were always brought up to think that we could do anything. But I think I realized the economic implications of this much more, funnily enough, when I was looking at the international economy. A lot of my work originally was, in fact, in international economics and on developing in a global economy and what it meant. And I came to realize that, first of all, there were all these huge differences in the way labor markets function and employment happens and how much diversification occurs. And a lot of those differences could be related to the gender constructions of those societies and how they used men and women differently in labor markets.
So, I mean, are there solutions out there? Are there any programs, policies that are happening right now in the world that are doing a better job of addressing unpaid care work, you know, in a way that makes society better?
Yes, I think so. And well, you know, if you want to think of the broad schema for this, I mean, feminist economists have been arguing what is called the five R's, okay, for unpaid care. First, obvious, recognize this care work. Acknowledge that it exists. Do the time use surveys that will measure how much care work people are doing and in what forms. Then, once you've recognized it, reduce as much as possible. In India, women spend hours and hours collecting water. So bring in public policies that enable water supply to every home, for example. But, you know, reduce a lot of the unpaid work, which can be easily done if public policy addresses that. The third thing then, redistribute. It shouldn't just be women and girls within households. They do about 75% of the unpaid labor time in the world. It shouldn't just be them. It should be spread between household, private provision, and the public sector. So you need public provision of things like childcare, of things like elderly care.
To free up women's time to do other things.
Yes, exactly. Then fourth, reward the care workers whom you do pay. I just told you about the workers in India who are not even called workers, who don't get even the minimum wage and yet have to do really difficult and demanding things. So reward care workers properly. And finally, represent care workers. Give care workers themselves a voice, including the unpaid care workers, who really, you know, there's no question of anybody even knowing what they want, because this is essential work, which is much more essential than a lot of people working in, let's say, global finance.
Right. But are some of these concepts being incorporated in programs that exist now?
Yes. In fact, you will find that there are a bunch of countries where there's been quite significant improvement in many of these indicators. Argentina in the 2000s, one of the important things they did was through child support grants that enabled a lot of the transfer of care activities domestically to paid care services. They enabled trade unions and labor unions of women workers, paid and unpaid. Costa Rica has been doing something similar. The state of Kerala in India brought in a lot of innovative ideas about care. So they created voluntary groups who are paid volunteers, but community volunteers for health, looking after elderly care, ensuring that the elderly got access to people beyond those living in their immediate homes and families. And they did a bunch of other things which actually shifted some of the burden of care. There have been care cooperatives formed in Italy. There's very interesting innovations in care work in Vietnam. So I think, yes, there are societies where things are being done. It's not easy and it requires a lot of pressure. Governments don't do this because they suddenly feel good. They do this because they have to. So I think the most critical thing is for voices to be raised and enough mobilization to occur for governments to feel they have no choice but to do some of these things.
Okay, well, I mean, Jayati Ghosh, your work really gives us all a lot to think about. and I thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
That was Rhoda Metcalf speaking with Jayati Ghosh, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. The next episode of this Women in Economics series will feature Diane Coyle, the Bennett Professor of Public Policy at the University of Cambridge. Look for it wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow us on Twitter at @IMF_podcast to make sure you don't miss anything. I'm Bruce Edwards.
And I'm Rhoda Metcalf. Thanks for listening.